Hello, and welcome to Viewpoints, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete.
On today's show, we'll be talking about preparing for college, everything you need to do to get ready to get in and pick the one you want to go to, including those wonderful standardized tests. We'll be talking with a high school senior, Rebecca, who you may remember from a couple of previous shows. She's visually impaired, and as we'll be discussing, that adds some extra factors to the college selection process. First, we'd like to turn to our tip of the week. This week's tip is get a mentor for every phase of your life. If you're lucky, it can start out being your parents. Then maybe you'll have a special teacher or more than one. Maybe you'll get lucky. You'll have a boss available to give you good advice, a clergy member, whatever. But get yourself a mentor for every phase of your life.
So as we said, we're going to feature Rebecca in another phase of her development through this science progress and getting through high school and into college. And she's going to talk a little bit about some people who have been important in her development, her interest in science and her getting along with visual impairment.
I guess high school for me was really about research and finding that love for research. So when I got into high school, there was a teacher who really kind of helped me get into research, but I ultimately put my current research teacher, Mr. Kurtz. He's an incredible teacher in general. He cares so much about his students. I think, so I've never met a teacher who actually like comes to visit you multiple times over the summer. Emails, we like instant message if I'm having problems or go on Skype. He's so proactive and really wants to help his kids do well. And for me, he was kind of like a great model for what I wanted to aspire to be, meaning that like I was being proactive about my own science. And he's also someone who sort of like, he really wants to show kids like the power of science, and that even though we do submit to a lot of competitions in science first, because that's sort of like the standard in high school, especially with the available scholarship money, that there's a lot more to science than just those competitions. And I think he was really influential to me because because that's sort of what I believed in. Like, I came into science doing science before competitions, and he kind of showed me that that's still there, and you can really, you don't have to just compete all the time. You really can just, like, love science and go for what you want to do. He's done a lot of cool things that have also showed me how if you have a specific interest, you can pursue it no matter what anyone says. For me, who studies computational biology, and it's sort of this like really, really new field, he sort of showed me that like if you want to pursue that really specific interest, you know, you should totally go for it. So that was my most influential person. It was hard to decide though, because I feel like every time I encounter someone new, like that I always get to take away new things about what I learn about, hopefully, you know, becoming a scientist and how I should approach things or learn from my mistakes. So, I mean, I don't think that there's one influential person. I think everyone really sort of played a role in who I am today.
The teacher that Rebecca talked about there, Mr. Kurtz, was the person who actually put us in touch with her initially. I went to the same high school as Rebecca is going to now, except that was 30 or 40 years ago. And I happened to be down there for some event, and they knew there was this blind ex-graduate alumni that went to this school. And out of the blue, after I got back home a few weeks later, I got this note from him asking if we would like to mentor some visually impaired science student of theirs. He knew we were scientists, and I was visually impaired. And that's how the relationship got set up.
And, you know, it's been very gratifying to us watching Rebecca. She calls us occasionally just to ask for advice about various things. And she's been making great use of us as mentors. And we hope she's been getting as much out of it as we have. But it's been terrific for us.
Yeah, it's been very rewarding for us also.
So among other things, some of her mentors and high school teachers have helped her to learn the importance of advocating for herself.
And you need to know how to advocate for yourself, I guess, in the right way, to not be harsh and to realize that you spend so much time, like, thinking about how you're going to try to make accommodations and work things out for yourself, that you have to remember that you're not the only one in the equation, and that while you do have a little bit of a disadvantage at times, you have to remember not to get frustrated and to really try to deal with the situation. View it, you know, view it as like someone who's not you. To say, like, if you're dealing with the teacher, how would the teacher feel if they got a student, or how would the professor feel if they got a student who had an extra set of accommodations to be made? You have to remember, like, you know, there's a way to solve it. Just step back and, you know, take a deep breath, and everything usually works out.
I always tell people the person that has your best interests at heart is yourself. So it's important to be your own advocate.
And, you know, if you think that you may have learned some life lessons along the way and you'd like to mentor a young person, there's an organization in Rochester, New York, where we are, called Rochester Mentors, and they have a web address, rochestermentors.org, or you can reach them at area code 585-271-4050, and they are looking for mentors to work with any number of young people who could benefit from any kind of advice that they could get, and support and connection with somebody who's had more experience than they have. And we've really enjoyed this relationship, and it's a great opportunity to make a difference in somebody else's life. Turning now to our low-tech item, we'll be talking about standardized testing. This is something that everybody who applies to college needs to do. And boy, I remember those tests, the PSAT, the SAT. We had a whole alphabet soup of them. Page after page after page of fairly small print with little circles we were supposed to fill in with a number 2 pencil, and don't even think about making a smudge. And I could see just fine, and it wasn't a lot of fun. Well, if you have a visual impairment and you still need to take them, there are other issues as well. And Rebecca took them a lot more recently than I did, and they're really fresh in her mind.
The first thing I like to say about standardized testing is that you cannot give a standardized test because there's no such thing as a standardized student, which makes us really hard for kids who have, you know, visual impairments or students to sort of try to fit that standard mold and take those exams. For me, the SAT, the ACT, and the subject tests that I took were particularly hard experiences because my accommodations made those exams so much more brutal than they probably had to be. I get double time, meaning my regular SAT turns from a 4-hour exam to an 8-hour exam. I do get to take it over 2 days. I find it still just draws out the experience, makes it a little harder to take. I read large print and braille, but I take my exams in large print. So that's an accommodation I get. And I can also have someone read the exam to me if I get tired. With my visual condition, I don't have much stamina for reading. So at the end of 4 hours, it gets really, really tough for me to read the exam, especially in the reading sections. Those are particularly hard. And they're actually pretty hard to just get accommodations from in general. They gave my family and I a really hard time. They actually didn't approve my accommodations originally. Basically, the reason they're doing that is because they want to make sure you really need it and that kids who don't need it aren't getting those accommodations. But, you know, it was a challenge. The ACT was easier to get accommodations for than the SAT.
So I'm kind of curious. You say they provided these in large print to you. Was that electronically or just on paper?
No, it's in print. If it were electronically, it would probably be easier for me.
I was kind of surprised after our talk with Rebecca that she wasn't provided some of these exams in a more accessible or more, you know, friendly format to her. Years ago, I took these tests, the SATs, the GREs for graduate school. They're all in large print, and I was given more time. And, you know, as she says, it's not easy because, you know, you have to lean over. You're looking close. It's physically demanding and mentally demanding also. But, you know, especially with the sensitivity about accessibility and things like that these days, I'm surprised there weren't better accommodations. So I guess we still have ways to go in terms of some of these tests and how people take them.
Well, many of the standardized tests for admission to graduate school are available electronically. In fact, when our daughter took the GREs for graduate school, they were only available electronically, and she can see just fine. But the tests for getting into college as an undergraduate are apparently not available electronically, and I don't know why.
You are listening to Viewpoints. Viewpoints.
Turning now to our focus item, this week's topic is selecting and applying to college.
So as you might imagine, I mean, if you have some low vision or some other disability, besides what kind of programs are offered at these colleges, there are some other issues that someone might consider. I mean, they might think about the accessibility of the school in terms of getting around and mobility, how friendly they are to providing access equipment and other assistance that you might need in your classes, your studies, and things like that. So Rebecca thought about many of these when she started making her list of colleges and when she went to look at some of these colleges, and she'll describe some of that to us.
I visited about 6 or 7 universities, and when I went to all of them, I made a point to either visit the Office of Disabilities or try to, like, set up a conference on the phone with them to talk about, you know, if I were to go to that school, what types of accommodations they would be able to provide me. It's also really important, I found, I asked if they had ever had a visual impaired student at their university before. Some did, which actually I liked, because I felt that in accommodating me, it wouldn't be like a constant guessing game. Having experiences is usually pretty helpful. I'm actually going to visit, my last college visitation is in September, and we're flying to Carnegie Mellon, and I'm going to meet with the disability director there, and we're going to talk about, I guess, if I were accepted, what accommodations I would get, and especially, like, I'm applying to a specific school, the School of Computer Science there. So I'm going to meet with the director of admissions there also, which is kind of my own little triumph, to be able to meet with him and say, you know, how would you be able to accommodate me? And also to make sure that it would be a good fit. I also would, like, walk around and say, okay, is this a campus that's really accessible to me? Like, how many steps and little cracks? Like, some of the older campuses, those aren't as great, especially if they're up north, if you're thinking about, like, the snow and the ice, and in the winter, if it's going to be difficult, if you're going to trip on patches of ice because you don't see them. Like, I definitely thought about that, how safe the campus is for me as a visually impaired student. Boston's a great place because even though it's up north, their city is really adapted to visually impaired people. They have all of the first street crossings. They have, like, the audio signals. So those were factors for me that also probably played a really big part. When I went up to Cornell, I really disliked the campus because I felt it wasn't safe because it was so large and there were so many major roads to cross. So that was, like, a big concern for me. And then, you know, so I sort of looked at it, like, collectively and said, like, okay, is this school going to be a good fit for me? In addition to all the other things I heard about their programs and their students and sort of what they had to offer, if I was going to apply or not. That's what I would kind of give advice for, is that when you're looking at a college, make sure it's, like, a good fit for you, and make sure you can see yourself there, comfortable there. Because you don't want to let anything stop you from, like, learning and enjoying that experience. I talked to students at those schools who are visually impaired also, that I looked at. So that was helpful to get, like, their insight and their experience.
That was neat. You were able to find visually impaired students in a lot of the schools you were looking at?
I've met a lot of kids. or even, like, if I knew students at those universities, if they knew if there are visually impaired kids there. Networking is a great tool. Even, like, before, I guess, a lot of my friends were applying to colleges who are visually impaired, we all talked about, you know, hey, when you get there, just kind of, you know, tell me how, you know, I have a friend who she's going to be in. She's actually at Yale this fall, and she's completely blind. I say, hey, tell me how you like it. Tell me how it works out for you, because, you know, Yale's an awesome school. But once again, if Yale's not going to be able to accommodate me, or if it's not going to be great, like, a good fit for me, then I wouldn't want to apply there.
So what are some of the ways you found to be effective at networking with other blind folks? I mean, there aren't a lot in your high school and stuff.
There are none in my high school.
Right. So what are some of the effective methods people might use to network with, you know, students in your situation?
So when I was younger, I went to this program that was sort of like for kids to get together who were had visual impairments. It was like 2 Saturdays a month. But I definitely talked to a lot of those kids. I also, in my sophomore year of high school, I went to the NASA space camp for students with visual impairments. So I met a lot of kids there who are also kind of bright like me and looking to go to the schools that I'm looking at. So we talk a lot about, you know, what schools are applying to and sort of the hurdles that we're overcoming.
So she mentioned a couple of programs that she'd participated in. The one that was 2 Saturdays a month was at the Helen Keller Services for the Blind in Huntington on Long Island. It's also known as the Industrial Home for the Blind. They actually run a large number of programs and have a lot of services for people with visual impairments, although they no longer run that Saturday program. But they can be reached at www.helenkeller.org. The space camp she talked about at NASA, oh my gosh, that is so cool. The official title is Space Camp for Interested Visually Impaired Students. And they can be reached online at www.tsbvi.edu/space, or their phone number is 304-822-4883. And another organization that runs weekend programs that she's sometimes participated in, but certainly not twice a month because it's 4 hours away from her home, is the Perkins School in Boston. And she's gone skiing with them and all sorts of other fun stuff, you know, where she's had a chance to meet other visually impaired people her age. And they're available at www.perkins.org.
And what's interesting is Rebecca talks about a number of resources. So, you know, whereas some people, if you have some sight, you don't think you have any problems, you may just look at some schools. She really availed herself of a lot of different resources to figure out about these schools, how good of a fit they might be for her, and how successful she might be at these places. And, the, you know, the message is there are a lot of these resources out there. Take advantage of them, search around, and do some of this homework, and you'll have a better chance at succeeding, getting into the place you like.
So it's been kind of fun for us. We met her almost a year ago to follow the progression of which school is her first choice. Well, first it was going to be MIT, and then it was going to be Johns Hopkins. And now she's got another first choice, and she sounds really enthusiastic about this one.
I went to visit Princeton over my summer vacation, the week of it that I technically had, and I loved it. This is an example of kind of considering the fit. So at Princeton, you can only major in one thing. You cannot double major. You can take like certificates, as those are their equivalent to a minor. The focus is on undergraduates. The campus was beautiful. I felt that it was a good fit for me academically because I wouldn't be pressured to sort of like do something that wouldn't be healthy for my vision. And I would still be able to pursue the interests that I love. And they have a computational biology program there. So there were just so many things about Princeton that I loved and felt were a great fit for me. Princeton's very hard to get into, so we'll see how that goes. It had a lot of features that I just, because originally I thought a city would be better because there would be a lot of transportation options. But I actually felt that Princeton was great because it was a very safe place to be. Like, there weren't huge street crossings and things that I could sort of trip on, or I felt like it was a really place that was friendly to being visually impaired. There were stores and like you can get around within the little town that Princeton sort of is without needing all of that, those extra transportation. It just had a lot of features that sort of came together. You know, I love Johns Hopkins as well. Johns Hopkins is further than Princeton. You know, I guess we'll see what happens with, you know, when the decisions come out where I decide to go. I really try to also, you know, make contacts based on my interest too. Like, I talk to professors at Princeton who sort of run the quantitative biology program. It's really about being proactive. The one thing that I've taken from this entire experience is that no one's going to, you know, especially when you're a high school senior and they're really trying to, you know, make sure you're independent, you have to sort of like go out and do these things for yourself, because no one's going to help you find the disability office and you know, make the decision what college is good for you. It's really something that you have to see for yourself and make sure that you can figure that out and take those steps.
So Nancy mentioned that Rebecca occasionally has come to call us up for advice about other things. And this is a discussion we had about whether or not she should get a guide dog.
So I'm sort of still, like, I'm pretty sure I'm moving towards getting a guide dog. I just still have a couple, like, hesitations about not even, like, taking care of the dog, but just if it's going to be a good fit for me to have the dog with me all the time. Because I'm a really active person, so not that I don't know if the dog would be able to keep up with me, but, I mean, it would be a really long day of, like, traveling and going around and doing all of these things. And I don't know if having a dog with me would make that harder. To not only be concerned about the things that I had to do during my day, but to take care of the dog. I did apply for it. Like, I put myself on the list so that if I want it before college, I can get one.
How long is the waiting list?
Well, I'm eligible for one. It just takes them a while to get a dog that's a fit for you. I think they said it takes like 8 months. But I guess we'll see what happens. I'm pretty sure I want to do it. I just have to, like, sort of make that final leap to do it, to go for it. Getting a month to give up in sort of my life and my scenario is very hard because I'm with the Bonneau Lab and I'm doing the work there. I'd sort of rather be there than doing residential training for a guide dog. So I'm also not sure if I'm ready to give up the time to do that at this stage of, you know, where I'm at. I'd rather be doing research.
So some of it may depend on the college you wind up going to, you think?
I think any, you know, college campuses, no matter where they are or what their layout is, a guide dog is going to be a useful thing.
And of course, in high school, everything was in one building, so she was fine getting around the entire, shall we say, campus with just a cane. But these college campuses are very spread out, and often there are paths running every which way, and I can really understand why she would feel that a dog would be useful.
Well, maybe we'll check in next year to see what happens.
Now for this week's high-tech item. This is the third time you've met Rebecca, and the last time we talked to her, she was talking about the research project that she had been doing for her science fair project, at which you may or may not recall, she placed really, really high in the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair. Well, based on the research she had done all by herself as a high school student, she contacted one of the professors whose original work she had been citing and got him to agree to allow her to work in his lab for pay on her project, which is almost unheard of for a student to be able to work on their own project, not the professor's project. And she spent the summer at New York University, which she refers to as NYU, in the lab of Professor Richard Bonneau. Here she is describing the content of her research. You'll be able to understand it. She does this very clearly.
Last year, I started working on this. Basically, it's a method or a computer program that predicts if a certain genetic mutation is going to cause a disease or not. I became really interested in working on that sort of research computational biology field because, as you know, I'm legally blind. And I was really interested in sort of studying how molecular changes result in, like, the symptoms that you see in all of these different disorders. So after kind of working on that prototype last year, I was invited to work in a lab at NYU, Richard Bonneau's lab, and that lab works on a really cool sort of state-of-the-art protein structure prediction suite, and that's called Rosetta. So what I did over the summer was I really sort of honed in on my focus, and I actually developed a new computer program. And what it does is it predicts if a mutation is going to cause a disease in a certain type of protein called a membrane protein, meaning it's bound through this sort of like phospholipid layer in the body. So, and those proteins are really important because they play a lot of roles in like visual impairments, hearing impairments, a lot of like neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's. That's really cool for me. And I actually just got results and my protocol works. So that's very cool. When I sort of started in the Bonneau Lab, I wasn't sure like how well it was going to work out because I had worked for a while on my own project and I didn't know how it was going to be, you know, like sort of starting to work with other people on it. It ended up being an absolutely amazing experience. People there are so receptive to ideas and it's probably a textbook model of what collaborative should be. So I'm actually continuing to work there. I'm still part of the lab no matter what, but I'm going to sort of work remotely during my senior year and try to get there when I can. And I'm going to work there through the end of next summer. And then I guess we'll see what happens depending on what college I end up at and what research I do.
So after working totally alone for several years doing her research, Rebecca really enjoyed this collaborative team experience doing research, and she gained a lot of experience and knowledge from that.
To me, it's just an amazing experience to like be in that environment where I get to work with this top performing program and integrate it into my protocol. And I mean, just sort of, so I always tell people, like, even after you do your work, you learn things about the research you did even after, when you're like writing it up. And I'm like, I was kind of the other night when I, you know, as I'm writing my research paper, I'm sort of looking at this and you realize like, wow, I did something really, really cool. Not only because I was able to predict these disease causing mutations in membrane proteins, but because like my method is, you know, like sort of coming from doing it on my own and not so sure of, you know, how well it would work to having this, this thing that performs incredibly well. It's like 75% accuracy rate, which is amazing for biology. So I'm really excited about that. And the whole experience of even just being in a lab was, you learn so much and you're constantly inspired to learn more and kind of pick up what you can to improve what you're doing.
So, you know, we always pre-record these shows, and this particular interview we recorded around Labor Day, so the school year had not yet begun. And now you're ready for another year of high school.
Yep, that's Wednesday.
Well, that'll be different from spending the summer at NYU.
It's going to be a fun year. Senior year is, the first 4 months are going to be very, very busy, and then hopefully I'll see, you know, the all the hard work that I did sort of pay off, and, you know, I'll get to enjoy the rest of the year as a senior.
And we'll keep our listeners informed as we follow Rebecca through high school and hopefully into college and stuff. I'm sure she'll do very well. She just soaks up new ways of doing things and knowledge, and is very enthusiastic about it, and it's great to see her progress.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Next week on Viewpoints, we'll be talking about accessible voting. In preparation for Election Day, we visited our local Board of Elections. You'll get to meet some of the people from the Board of Elections, learn about the history of accessible voting options, and hear a demonstration of New York's brand new accessible system of voting. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to reachout@wxxi.org or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Viewpoints, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. This program was hosted by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey. We hope you'll join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show by going to our website at wxxi.org/reachout and clicking on the podcasts link. Thanks for listening to Viewpoints, and have a nice day.